Lincoln Avenue in Cross Continental, Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Alan Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix. I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Jamal Sawyer-Dimsky and Greg Borison, both senior game developers who work with me, to discuss the topic of wandering into game development. Kind of like wandering through that intro. So if everyone's ready, let's go. We are all over the place right now. We've got Mark is in secondary Minneapolis location. Stephen and I are in downtown Minneapolis. And Jamal, you're on West Coast. And Greg, you're also on West Coast-ish?
Yeah. I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada. So somewhere I've lived for the past 5 years.
Oh, that's Northwest Coast? I don't know where Vancouver is. I feel like I should...
It's north of Seattle.
Ah, oh, okay.
Yeah, just cross the Canadian border and it's there. I was like, pretty much immediately.
Mark, don't tell Dale I didn't know where Vancouver was.
She could probably guess you didn't know where Vancouver
was.
Yeah,
that's true.
But that's the thing about Americans in Canada is like, Canada is like, oh, it's North Coast,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, we don't.
Yeah.
It's just, we don't really, it's just over the border and then it's all Canada. Like,
yeah, pretty much.
Jamal, you're in San Diego.
Yes, I am in La Mesa, California, which is just a little bit east of San Diego proper. And I've been here for approximately 1 month now.
Oh, wow.
So just moved from New York.
That's a big transition.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Speaking of transitions.
Are we just going to jump right into the topic?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, the topic... I guess we are. We're wandering into this too. Okay. So the topic is wandering into game development. And I think what we mean by that specifically is both of you have, you had separate careers, different careers from video game development before. And you ended up in video games. And we're curious, why? Why would you do that to yourselves? But also, like, what made you decide to change? Like, what happened to that career shift happened?
Which one of us should start?
Jamal, do you want to go first? I guess I'll just pick someone.
Sure. It's kind of bizarre, I guess. The reason would be necessity, actually. I switched careers from, I graduated school in New York with a music degree, and for a period of time, like 7 or 8 years, I was a professional musician in the New York scene, play saxophone. And at a certain point in time, I made the decision that I needed to switch careers. I sort of thought about the future and that might be slightly less fun at 40, 50, et cetera. So I went to go get my master's degree in actually digital forensics and cybersecurity, which is kind of a stretch from a music performance BFA, but
100%.
So while I was pursuing that degree, I ran into complications. And the complications were that the master's programs in the all presume that you have a salaried job that you are working and perhaps taking the courses at night or after work. Mm. So they scheduled all the master's courses later in the day, which meant that the inverse was true for me, right? So it was causing a terrible financial situation for me where all of my gigs and the money that I would be making gigging at night sort of was drying up because I was taking classes and I had to sort of quit taking on paying musical work. So what happened for me was that I essentially got into game development because I needed money and my roommate's boyfriend was working on an educational video game for the government, teaching math. Let me just take a step back and say that the master's program for cybersecurity, digital forensic stuff, it was a very high level degree, involved like hacking and network security and operating security, operating system security and this sort of thing. And there was a general expectation that you would know like many different programming languages. and that this was just assumed, right? And these classes were really tough, and just they'd make you do something completely different every single week. And so to get through crunching how to actually program in a lot of these languages, what I would do is I would just find an audiovisual library for that language, or I would find a game engine built in that language. And then I would just compose something really quickly, like maybe just some fun prototype or something, in order to just learn the language, right?
Yeah.
And so back to my roommate's boyfriend, I had built several like little game prototype things for myself, and she was just constantly watching me in my room, just, you know, hammering away at all of these games, because of course you got to show people after you build it, right? I'm like, come in here, look at this, look at this, look at this. And she was like, you know, my boyfriend's working on a video game, you know, he's saying he needs a programmer for it and this and that. And so I ended up meeting him at a coffee shop, and I totally swindled him. He was looking for a JavaScript game developer, because the program was a web application. It was a web-based game. And this is the period in time when Flash was dying, because Apple refused to support it on their iPhone. So newer web games were being built with just like HTML5 stuff, you know, and JavaScript game engines, which nobody knew how to use properly. So anyways, he asks me in this interview about, like, you know, do you know JavaScript? Do you know this? Do you know that? And I said, yeah, of course I know JavaScript. Here, take a look at this thing that I built. And what I didn't know at the time was that I hadn't actually built what I had written in JavaScript at all. And what had happened was, is we're all familiar with the Unity game engine.
Oh.
And in the very, very, very early days of Unity,
you used to be able to code in Unity script or whatever it was, like that offshoot of JavaScript.
So, right? So they went and they call it Unity script now, but back in the day, they were like, hey, you can code in JavaScript. So I was like, oh, this is JavaScript. I guess I'm coding in JavaScript. It's awesome. Easy. Boom. Done. So I showed him that. And then he was like, wow, this is incredible. You did this in JavaScript? And I'm like, yeah, man. Like, I'm crushing it. And then shook hands, got the deal, you know, got the job. And the thing about the job was he was paying $1,000 per level, right?
Oh.
That was the arrangement we had. I was just like, you know, I'll pay you $1,000 per level. I said, you better get ready. You better get ready for like one level a week, because your boy needs the money. I'm gonna be hitting you with these levels like this, right? So basically, long story short, I went back home after he, you know, hired me for this job. I had a week before I was gonna start. I then sort of did some investigation, realized I didn't actually know how to code games in JavaScript. I downloaded a book from O'Reilly, you know, the book publisher O'Reilly, about how to code games in JavaScript. And they happened to be using the same, for his book, he was using the same engine that we were going to be using for this project, which was called ImpactJS, which is the OG original JavaScript game engine, the first like really fully compiled sort of JavaScript game engine that everybody sort of got hooked into. So I slammed that book to my brain in a week, showed up the next week, and just started crushing levels. Started crushing levels for this guy, and that is basically how I sort of stumbled into it, because we completed this game together. It was great. We made another one together, which was great, while I was still in school. And then I left the master's program and got poached straight away to go into a digital forensics lab, which they don't look like the CSI TV shows. With the blue light, the blue ambient light, and the massive, you know, screen.
They don't? Wow. I'm surprised.
Yeah. It's not like that. So
not a lot of real-time typing battles either.
Yeah. There's no hacking phone, and the progress bar moves slowly to the right, you know, with the skull and crossbones.
Did you say enhance once at all?
Only internally. what I will say, quick tangent. Mr. Robot, if you've ever watched Mr. Robot,
love that show.
They actually have a slavish devotion to accuracy.
Yeah.
And if you'll remember, I can't remember how long this lasts for, but at least in the first season, he works in a digital forensics lab, and they made sure that everything was legit about everything that he was using and doing, including the reports that he delivered to his boss were the exact same formatting as the reports that Encase, which is like the industry standard tool, prints out. I was like, blown away. It was insane.
That's cool.
But year and a half there at the forensics lab, I realized that this was not the job for me. Mm-hmm. And I started looking for programming jobs. And as happens when all that's on your resume is educational web games, you find it very easy to slip into another educational web game job, and then from there to the next one, and there to the next one. So that's kind of how I slipped into the game development track.
I imagine, I mean, that mirrors a lot of people's stories, I think, in a lot of ways. I think that the way that I got into games is I made a bunch of projects myself, and then I started looking for jobs, and then they saw the stuff I was doing, and I told them, yeah, I can do all these things in Unity. I can make networking and whatnot, and they fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. I think that mirrors a lot of things, and I imagine that listeners would probably feel a little more comfortable hearing how others are getting into development as well. Mm-hmm. Greg, how did you get into the games? Are there similarities between your story and Jamal's?
Well, yeah, it didn't happen on purpose.
right.
Yeah. So my previous career was a variety of different kinds of IT positions, mostly at the University of Alberta in Edmonton in Canada. I actually, like, when I was a young nerd in school, I was doing a lot of web development for like my high school back in the 90s, and then some community organizations, and then I started working for the University of Alberta Students Union in 2000. That was after a brief stint as a online news editor for a long defunct Macintosh oriented news website and magazine that printed a few editions before going bankrupt. I was kind of following a trail of contacts through a variety of different jobs with increasing responsibilities. Eventually, I was working for the U of A itself. I spent a good number of years working with the Dean of Students Office there, supporting their disability services department, as well as the student health services as well, and a broader range of oftentimes getting into where the creative side of technology needed support. So dealing with all of the obscure problems that everyone encountered with everything that they needed to do for print publishing, occasionally doing some bits of web development for registration systems, for systems that would plug into the electronic health record system. Some web presentation stuff, but it was like increasingly server oriented as time went on. Mm-hmm. And I eventually wound up at their central IT department doing kind of a complicated DevOps job where I was running a small team that was looking after a shared learning management system that was being used by like 200,000 students between a few different universities. That was really when my job became more like heavily development focused, was during that last part of my time there. But there were also a number of management changes that had been going on that were making it be a little bit more problematic of a place to stay for advancement potential. And my partner Alyssa got a job opportunity in Vancouver, so I moved here with her from Edmonton. As I was trying to get my bearings in a new city and figure out what I was going to do next, I was pretty open to doing different things. And my first thing was I took a web development contract for an acquaintance that I'd met at a music festival a few years ago.
Oh.
well, a few years before that. And that was doing website for a company called Anemone Hug Interactive, who I then worked for for a few years before moving over to where I currently work. So at Anemone Hug, like after doing their website, hey, can you do this this little game that for this client of ours? They want to have like a combat visualizer for this collectible, trainable fantasy character combat game that lives on Ethereum. And it went through like several dozen different names and disappeared promptly after I finished my work on it. But that was kind of interesting because I was just like dealing with the Phaser game engine, which is one that we use a lot of in our work now. And mm-hmm. So like that was my first time touching Phaser. And it was having to essentially make a way for these battle stats to play out with a visualizer of who won and why kind of thing. Because Ethereum isn't really known for doing a whole lot of real-time work, so it has to kind of crunch on everyone's battles that they set up. And then when the smart contract results are available, then there was this extra like Phaser game that just showed them how it went. And that was my first like serious game project, and it lasted about 4 weeks, so it really wasn't all that long. And just using some bundles of off-the-shelf rigged characters and working with an animator to adjust those, and putting up a bunch of little combat scenes with convincing characters beating each other up. And it was pretty all right. And then after that, I went into a much shorter stint working on a Unity game where I actually got fired from the project 4 days into it because they actually just didn't think I was experienced enough. And I'm like, yeah, maybe. That seemed like it was a plausible way to interpret things then, but I definitely solved some pretty bizarre elevator bugs in this particular very popular survival horror game that I'm not going to mention by name. And figured out how to do all kinds of odd things with sounds appearing in the right places at the right times when various horror things are happening. But it was good learning, though kind of short. Then after that, I started working on some contracts for there's sort of pseudo game educational courseware for kids through one of TGA's longtime clients called EverFi. And I got into a bunch of those and then started working on broader projects for TGA, including a few games that wound up in the training arcade, and then just moved over to work for them directly full time a few years later. So that's kind of how I wound up here. And I had done some dabbling when I was much younger in game-related stuff, but it just had really fallen off of my field of what I was focusing on for probably a good 15 years. In the early 2000s, I was doing some mods and levels for Bungie's Marathon and Myth series of games, and was getting into a team of people who are like trying to figure out how to make level editing tools before Bungie was on board with that, which was kind of fun. Involving hacking the hex code in resource files that lined up with certain parameters for levels or entities in the game. And that was pretty fun. And I had a group of people that I worked with on a mod for, I think that was for Myth 2, that actually wound up getting released on Bungie's updated version of it. They like re-released it later, and they had a bunch of community mods on it, and included one of the ones I worked on.
Cool.
So, yeah. So that was like way back in the day. Then I'd just been doing all of this like education, IT, general, figuring out whatever needs to be figured out stuff, trying to like plan server migrations and things like that, and deal with trying to keep services up and running 24/7 and all that kind of stuff. So I picked up a lot of useful things along the way, but yeah, it really was just an accident that occurred from having met someone at a music festival and moving to a city when I just felt like I was open for a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our career advice. Show up at a music festival and harass your roommate's boyfriend.
Yeah.
That's how you get into game development.
One of those is bound to work. Well, the theme for both of your stories is I mean, the title of the episode, like Wandering In. And Stephen, you were saying it's not uncommon for people to have that kind of story.
Right.
So for either of you, along the way, and I know this is true of me, which is why I'm asking it of you. Along the way, as I transitioned from a previous career to games, I never thought of myself as someone who was in the career of games until very, very recently, like including after we started this podcast.
Oh.
And so I wonder if for either of you that felt similar, that it felt like it was something you're trying, something you're doing now, because it was such a slow evolution or a natural progression. Was there ever a moment where you're like, oh, now I've switched from that to this? Or was it when you got a taste of it, you're like, okay, now I'm going to chase that direction?
I mean, I feel like I basically had complete imposter syndrome like for the past 10 years, all the way up until like maybe like a year ago or 2 years ago. I never really thought of myself as a game developer or like thought about like that being my career, you know. I it's totally unexpected to me, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty similar here. I definitely like it. And the more that work because we deal with like a spectrum of things that are loosely gamified to things that present vaguely like games but are mostly just courseware, to things that are actual games that are usually teaching some concept. I'd say that some of the most satisfying work that I've been doing is on the actual like game side of it, like trying to get everything really tightly figured out and optimized. But yeah, considering myself a game developer, like, yeah, maybe. Maybe I am that.
That's my job.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of what my job is like having enough of that and like being able to work with clients on custom projects and help determine their technical requirements and help make sure that we aren't getting ourselves into a pickle so that we're going over budget or over time. You know, like it's a little bit more that kind of thing than game development day to day, except for when we do get into those really fun, heavily game projects, and they could be a real blast.
I wanted to add to my answer. The one thing I will say is I knew that I was making a commitment to pursuing game development as a career after, I think maybe there was a period in time where after I left the forensics lab, the contracts I was getting were primarily converting Flash games to just, you know, JavaScript. And that work was coming in, but it wasn't coming in like, there wasn't like enough money. I wanted more money. and so I committed to making a portfolio or like something I could show to clients. Because the other problem was, is like a lot of the work I was doing, I just like wasn't allowed to show anybody anything. Mm-hmm. For my portfolio piece was building a multiplayer game for iPhone, and then, you know, using JavaScript, using HTML, using like Apache Cordova. And I spent like 2 months like really putting that together and shining and polishing it. And I would say that at that point, even though that was still relatively early on, I think I could look back on that and say that that was making a firm commitment to like choosing this as a direction to pursue in programming as a career moving forward, right? Because I could have put up a website and made, you know, like look at my, you know, homepage registration form or something. You know, I could have put up like portfolio examples of something more generalized, but putting together a like a pixel art warrior themed rock, paper, scissors game with achievements and you know, live multiplayer was a choice. So
one thing I really liked about both of y'all's stories is that like you were scrappy, but like you ended up like being on a project and you didn't necessarily know all of the things you needed to know to do the thing, but you learned it because you had past experiences where you needed to learn things quickly on the fly. And you learned those things and you were able to, you know, use that information to finish the project and use that and turn that into a career. And I think that's really cool. I imagine that that quality has taken you through all of your careers, but specifically in game dev in particular. Would you say that would be the case?
Like being able to learn stuff quickly?
Yeah. Because I think like, I know some game developers who went through the traditional route where they went to school for not just even programming, but specifically game development.
Yeah.
These people, you know, they're very talented and they have like a lot of the background education stuff that I don't have. They'll be talking about a concept and I'll be like, I don't know what the heck that is. But I think that like because they have that background, they tend to go to that background to help them through things. And it sometimes makes it a little bit more difficult to just start something completely new.
Oh, yeah. Here, I need you to make a game in a short amount of time, duct tape and chapsticks.
Yeah. And they'll like start by being like, well, we should just throw out the whole thing and start over. And we're like, we don't have time for that. We got to work with the duct tape we've got currently. So I guess what I'm asking is I'm wondering, do you feel like you have that quality? And has that quality, if you do or you don't have that quality, how has that helped with your career? It's a very weird question. I realize.
I think that like that's just a very valuable quality for anyone to have working in game development. How do you parse the unknowns into something that you can like carry out, and how do you get from there being a lot of unknowns to something where they're a little bit more manageable and you're reasonably confident that that this solution is actually going to do something close to what you intend it to do. I think that that's something that that was a skill that I did develop all through my previous career, and that it's where that largely unrelated technical background helps. And I'm also a person who just like I love to teach myself new things all the time whenever possible, and I kind of prefer like self-directed investigation into things that to like taking courses just in general. But yeah, like in my current work, it's definitely a lot of how do we figure out where to go from what we have based on some amount of research and identifying what our problems are and figuring out what other new tools we can use that we've never used before that may help us in the places where we've been, you know, like losing time, like things just not working very well or having performance issues, or in places where we really just need to move forward with our tech stack because it's aging and certain parts of it are dangerously aging, then it can be a lot of how to figure out what's going to happen next in what sequence. I think I do have that quality, and a lot of the other people I work with also have it. I think that the more that anyone is tied to one specific way of doing anything, that's going to hold them back. The technology is changing constantly, and you're going to need to do something unfamiliar in the near future.
Like probably this week.
Yeah. This week.
Yeah, completely. I guess for me, I would say that the background in music was extremely helpful in the sense of, I noticed this, and this isn't a, I guess this isn't much of a not, this isn't like, I'm not slamming computer science majors or anything, but I found that when I was in the master's program, and by proxy, they made me take like all the prerequisites of a computer science degree while I was there as well. I found that the people that were there, not all of them, but many of them were like used to getting a manual and like if, or like a recipe, like a cookbook, right? Like there's a recipe and it's just like, if the thing that we were supposed to try to do was not on, there wasn't a clear like recipe for how to do it that was known, they might flounder a little bit.
Yeah.
And I found that at least in my experience, like being a little bit looser with it in a sort of a, having had some musical training, I always thought about it kind of like composition, right? Like it's as if like, you know, the client is asking you to write a blues, right? And the blues has certain rules, you know, 12 bars, like has to do this, has to do that, has to do that. And you have your toolkit, right? I guess with music, it would be, you know, the 12 notes. But within that set of restrictions, there's a freedom to get to the end goal in a lot of different ways, right? Like yeah. you can write a blues many different ways, many different styles, and it's still a blues, right? So I think I was just always more open to getting to the destination. At least among my compatriots in that like sort of program, I was more like open to exploring different ways to get there. And if there wasn't a recipe directly written for it, I was willing to like experiment with like taking this from this, this from this, this from this, and like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So I think that was all very useful to me. I think that I'm like Greg, I'll learn by doing, right? I would struggle more in an environment where you made me read the manual and then do something versus like, I want to do something and I know I have to use this tool, so I'm going to figure out how to get what I want out of it and use that as the motivation to figure something out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very diplomatically stated. But it's one of those things, I think it's a mindset thing, right? Yeah. Like I think you know, a lot of people don't understand that just being a pure programmer involves so much creativity in a way that isn't really recognized by people outside the profession or even really within the profession, yeah. Right? Like when you talk about like finding new ways to do things, like that is something programmers do, and it's every bit as creative as an oil painter. And it, but when you don't think of your task as having that element, you'll still do it, but then it does limit you in terms of like how far you'll go or what options are open to you. Because you don't realize you actually have those abilities to be improvisational, to be sort of inventive, because maybe the way you were taught or just the way you think, and because it's, you don't see yourself as one of the beatniks, right? But we all are, yeah. If we want to be.
Can I actually add something onto that too? That's actually slightly frustrating with mm-hmm. with programmers in general and game development.
We're getting called out.
So this is, and you know, maybe Greg can speak to this too, but the other secret sauce I had going was I played a lot of video games in my life, a lot of video games. And so I know what a video game is supposed to feel like, right? How it's supposed to taste. And it really is frustrating to me and has been frustrating to me over time when you ask programmers to do something. You know how it is. You get mock-ups, you get wireframes, but they're not the whole story, right? Mm. And it's like you gotta have some sauce, you gotta have some style. I mean, like just because the artist didn't explicitly tell you the UI, you know, that it reacts to being hovered or that when you click it, just because he didn't explicitly state any of that to you, doesn't mean that stuff, the devil's in the details, in the mm-hmm. polish, and you got to have things tweening. I got to have, everything's got to be tweening a little bit. It's got to have a vibe, because there's no point if there's no vibe. And the amount of times I've had programmers that I've been working with, and it's just like the wireframe has a button on the screen, and then when the button is clicked, the thing happens, and there's no transition. There's no animation. There's nothing to it. And, you know, it's I always found that extremely frustrating. It felt like a very, I don't know, maybe I'll throw some shots across the bow here. But like sometimes I feel like sometimes I feel like programmers are like too literalist, like letter of the law, like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like I was told to make the button open the menu. So therefore they click the button completely disappears from the screen and the menu completely appears from the screen and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, I think some of that, like either extreme amounts of video game playing or just like being more of a creative person has influenced some of my approach to that, which in addition, I don't know. Maybe I'm just bringing this up and throwing shots for no reason.
But I don't mean to blunt your criticism, but I think what I totally know what you're talking about. And I've seen that in people too. And I think it's not always a lack of imagination or a lack of desire. It's very frequently a lack of agency. So the programmer doesn't know that they can be cross-disciplinary. And no one's giving them permission to do that. And so, I mean, like I said, not to blunt your criticism, because sometimes people just like the box they're in and they'll just stay there without it, not having the initiative. I think a lot of it is just not being given the opportunity to participate in sort of adjacent fields or not knowing that it is totally within your abilities to participate in those adjacent fields. Like a lot of programmers. Programmers will be like, I'll put in some dev art, whatever, but I'm not an artist. And you're like, well, why not? Why aren't you? It's like, it's fine if you don't want to be, or it's fine if another artist comes in and paints over it, but you can inform that element of it if you want to. And you do have those abilities. And I think not being told that you, or not being assured, or not being given the chance to demonstrate them, I think people can crawl into their little box, and not because they like it there, sometimes maybe, but because no one's, you know, sort of led them out.
I would add to that I think sometimes two things. One, you can try to do that, and if you're not reinforced or acknowledged for trying that, I suppose early on.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what's the point of trying? Like, I drew a cool thing, or I did this cool thing, and someone else just came and already had a design for it, and they just bowled it over. But like, to your point, Jamal, those little details are what makes something come alive. Otherwise, it's basically just like, I don't know, it's just
a slideshow.
Yeah, it's a slideshow.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel like an organic living thing.
Mm-hmm.
It reacts to what you're doing. Every little thing that you do, it has a reaction.
Yeah.
But if someone's bringing that kind of, you know, I wanted to say juice. Yeah, sure. We'll go with juice.
Sure.
Like if someone's bringing that kind of juice to their work and they don't get reinforced early on, then they're just going to stop, especially, and this comes to my second point, especially if they consistently get crunched.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If you don't have time and the headspace to play with that a little bit, and to feel like that kind of time isn't going to be considered a waste, then you're going to be conditioned over time to stop. It's one of the things I really like about working with TGA, and I've had the blessing of being able to work with teams who appreciate that as much as possible, even outside of TGA, but like, I can definitely imagine how that could be trained out of somebody by the culture of their previous work experience.
Yeah. I will say that I am that person who just puts the button and it clicks and the menu pops up. So I feel especially called out, and that's okay.
You're a science major?
Huh? No, I majored in mechanical engineering.
That's very true.
Twice and flunked out anyway. but the reason, so I will explain myself a bit. The reason why I do that is because I'm not a visual artist person. Well, I don't know. It's not something I prioritize as much. I'm much more about the game design. From my perspective, it's frustrating when I'm doing a thing and in my mind, I'm like, all the numbers make sense and this design is interesting and like people are making cool decisions and stuff. But like, because the menu doesn't transition neatly, they don't feel that. And like, I understand exactly why that's the case, because like, it's not an exciting thing if you just see a number go up, right? The number's got to like explode on the screen and be colorful and stuff. Otherwise, it's exciting for me, for me. But like, I know what it's supposed to mean, and I can understand that underlying design behind it. But like, you still need to be able to portray that excitement to people who don't know all of the numbers and such in the background. So like, I think it's very important. But I don't want to be the person to have to put it in. It's basically what. But I'm so glad you brought that up, because, like, I think, you know, all of the different backgrounds and stuff, all of our different backgrounds and things come together to make the decisions that you make, you know, your day-to-day job. And so like I prioritize the game design and making sure that things function over making sure that things look good as they function, because it's not something that I personally want to prioritize, want to care about, but I know that I need to care about it. And so if I do need to, or people are giving me feedback that's like, well, I can see all the stuff that I can do, but it's unclear what I can't, what I should do and what I shouldn't do. Then I'm like, okay, well, now I got to start prioritizing. I got to make things look flashier so it's clear that this button, you know, is the cool one. And so it flashes and bubbles up or something.
Yeah.
Tweens. You know, all of those.
I understand. Yeah. I understand. I mean, and listen, in your defense, I mean, I just want to say that the first programming job I took, that first $1,000 I took, mm-hmm. I got the game design document, read through it, immediately found that it had game-breaking issues in it.
Oh, yeah.
Immediately started arguing with the game designer.
Yeah. Right.
I'm that guy. Yeah. Right. I'm the guy who's I'm like, no. And I remember this. I argued. He was like, just do your job. What are you doing? And I was like, no, the game design is broken. I'm going to film myself playing it. I'm going to break my own level 5 times in 5 different ways to show you how it's broken.
Yeah.
Like, and here's my proposal for an alternative, and like blah 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 blah. So I think I'm less of that guy now, but I was the one who would just like come in here and with my own ideas, and you know, I was always like, well, you know, I'm gonna make some transitions for this stuff, and I'm gonna put some animations in here, and if the creative team doesn't like it, they'll let me know, and I'll switch it to how they like it.
Yeah.
But I always would come in with my opinions, so I'm that guy. So to be fair.
Pause for a minute. I broke something in the recording.
Oh, no. So I just found out, Ellen just informed me, that there are reviews on our Patreon.
Yes.
I didn't even know you can see reviews on Patreon.
Yes, you can.
You can review our Patreon content.
Yeah.
So that's neat. Do you have those up?
I sure do, Steven. Okay. Yeah, I just pulled up my... the Patreon, because I was going to mention the different tier levels that we have.
There are three.
Starts at $2.50 USD per month, right. And it tops out at 10.
I think you can donate any number you want too, though, because you know we appreciate it.
Yeah, we're not going to stop.
Yeah, yeah. You want to just give us a dollar? That's cool.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, but here's the reasons. Some of the reasons why. So you're going to feel so good about yourself.
Okay.
Mission Dolly gave us 5 stars.
Ooh, wow.
And said, come for the inside look at different facets of the game's scene from 3 uncompromisingly kind and clever devs. Stay for the Bants.
Bants.
I like it too. I like Bants. That's good. And then, let's see. Super Jump TMR said, recently found this podcast and it's amazing. Very informative, insightful, and really helpful. And the hosts are all super swell and enjoyable to listen to.
Yay! Oh, thank you so much.
Swell.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's there are more reviews. You can go on to Patreon.
You can leave us a review too if you are a patron.
Yes, if you're a patron, you can leave us your own very, very swell review. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/nicegamestuff.
Yes. That's patreon.com/nicegamestuff. See you there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So Jamal, that idea of being sort of hopelessly cross-disciplinary, I very much sympathize with that. And that is the opposite end of the problem, right? Is when you just want to do everything, even when it's not your job. And you started that story earlier by saying, I needed this money. And so you like, I need to do this job, this $1,000 per level. And then now you, an addendum to this story is like, oh, and I was also volunteering a ton of unpaid work because I couldn't help myself. Like, I totally know what that feeling is. And, but your attitude is right. It's perhaps a bias that maybe isn't fair, but like Steven, you're saying, I don't necessarily want to do those things, even though I know they need to be done. And in my mind, I'm like, well, you should at least sort of want to do it, right? Like even if you do it bad and let someone else finish it, but like that's my bias is like, I can't focus on one thing. And because everything is holistic, everything is connected to everything else. Mm-hmm. But you can get lost doing that as well.
Oh yeah.
Or I'm saying that as I assume
it's never happened to me. Yeah, Mark's like,
in my heart, I don't totally believe it.
Never happened to me, says Mark.
I have to allow for that fact. But Jamal, you came from music, and then you're in this other field, and it's impossible not to see that these things are always connected. And it's a thing that neither of us will probably ever get over. You think?
Oh yeah. When you're like, I mean, I have to cut myself off. I mean, I've gotten better at it, but I've been there. I don't know if you've been there, but you're like watching some animation happen, and you're like adjusting easing functions and like durations and timings and delays, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching the same like 3 second animation to see if like step three, if the duration is set from 0.4 to 0.2,
oh, yeah,
if it's like better. And then I'm sitting there and then I'll take a step back and I'll be like, you know that you cannot tell the difference.
Yeah,
like actually, like in real life, like you've been sitting here for 90 minutes looking at the same 3 second clip, and I'm like, you know you can't tell.
Yeah. So
what are you doing?
Like, Steven, you should be able to relate to that, because those are the numbers that matter to animators.
I totally relate to that.
Some numbers matter, I'll admit. Like
No, of course. I mean, obviously, like broadly speaking, the numbers matter, but I'm talking about it reminds me of a funny story. I was on tour with this guy, this band, and one of the horn players, this guy would be at the mic, and you know, we're doing sound check. And it's just like, we're sound checking before, you know, an hour before the gig, and then we're going to go and eat, and then we're going to come back and play. And this guy would be sitting up there, and he would be like, I need the high mids turned up. Can you adjust the reverb on the low end for me? You know, all this nonsense. Hmm. And I remember one time I was looking, I went around the back to the sound guy, and I was looking at him, and while this guy was doing sound check, and he's like, yeah, can I get the highs a little bit higher? And the engineer was just sitting there like, doing nothing at the console, and you just like look at it for a second, and then you look back up, you're like, how's that? You know? And you're like, oh, perfect. And I was looking at him, I said, I see you. He's like, yeah. He's like, my strategy is I just like, you know, they say the same thing twice, I'll adjust it because they actually mean it. But I'm like, I don't think you can tell them. I'm just gonna.
Yeah.
Was he a trumpet player?
Yeah.
No, saxophone player.
Oh. Okay.
Another saxophone player. Why is there some trumpet player?
My husband's a trumpet player. He studied jazz trumpet, so I like to rip on trumpet players.
Yeah.
That's what I get to do.
Well, the thing that engineer knows that probably not that a lot of the traveling musicians don't know is that all of these venues have terrible rooms, right? So like, none of it matters anyway.
Yeah, there's a very focused spot where it'll sound like anything half decent, and everywhere else it'll be bouncing off of too many random brick walls all over the place.
So I remember that story in my head sometimes when I'm looking at something too closely, you know, I'm like, just let's move on. This is we've gone too far.
Yep.
And I think that's always a struggle when you really do like dive into the details and when the aesthetics of something like concern you, like to the point of you're trying to implement a design and you're not sure if you have it quite right and you're fussing over it too much. Really like bouncing back up to the big picture and especially looking at how it is in relation to everything else that exists to decide whether it's something that actually stands out that needs that fussing. It's so easy to get lost in it every time. Back to what Jamal was saying about the frustration of people just like literally interpreting what they're given. Like that is not that is our best work happens when there's more of a conversation that's happening continuously, and that conversation can be really helpful in terms of figuring out where the effort does need to be spent, in that it can help, you know, reveal the issues with the game design that, what about this edge case that could throw everything off? Do we need to account for that? It can be issues with the visual design. It can be like the issues in the actual implementation and like what's not behaving properly. Like the more that that is a back and forth between all of the interested parties, the better. And when programmers are just executing and trying to get it done as quickly as possible and just call it a day, well, then you kind of need to have someone else to like raise the issues because the issues will just go on through and people won't pay as much attention to them. Cause usually the programmer is the last line before, possibly some, client representative or producer signing off on it, but even then not everyone is paying the closest attention to what exists. So yeah, I think that there does need to be a bit of that that, you know, constructive pushing back a little places, as well as, you know, offering something that is an idea for how it could help improve how it feels. And like actually concerning yourself with how it feels rather than just how it functions, I think is also really important.
Yeah. And I think that's like part of my intention with why I do so crappy a job with the transitions and stuff is because I know it's supposed to be temporary and I make it look very temporary, right? Because otherwise, because, you know, everything's happening so quickly and like there's so everybody else has their own work that they have to get done, there are going to be those little tiny things that fall through the crack. If this thing is very obviously not going to work in the final build, then people will say something about it. And
that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a very clever technique.
Yeah, it's like the whole technique of like posting a wrong answer to somebody on the internet because you don't know the right answer, but by posting the wrong answer, you know someone's going to swoop in there right away with the right one.
Otherwise, they won't say anything at all.
Exactly. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
It's a valid strategy for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes it's nice to just get something up there to have that conversation about what requires additional work. And and
people are really good at pointing out what they don't like, but they're not good at pointing out what they do like a lot of the time. And I think that's a good way of phrasing it. Yeah.
But also, like, if you're just the one hammering back and forth on change between 0.15 seconds and 0.1 seconds, which I've done, like... And, you know, but if you're not bringing anybody else into that process, then you're not getting feedback, but also you don't always have the best idea of like what it needs. Right.
Right.
Especially if you're not in the role to decide that, which is, you know, sometimes you are, sometimes you aren't. But I think one of the things that requires is that sense of being familiar with other disciplines is good, but it's dangerous in that not just that you'll sort of do that, but also, like, you're not always in the right position to know how much of that the project needs. Someone else might be in maybe that person is a stakeholder, maybe that person is another expert on the team. They might have a better idea, better understanding. They're just better briefed on what solution or when they'll recognize the right solution, right?
Yeah, completely.
And so bringing other people in on that process, even if you're doing needless fiddling and driving everybody crazy, like everybody will benefit from you opening doors a little bit, letting, you know, getting that feedback and that understanding. And I think, like Steven, you're saying that's what you're doing, right? You're saying this needs this. This is my contribution to that, and that's your way of saying like let's everybody else get in on it so that you recognize that. Because sometimes if you just do it like there's nothing, that can feel like a solution to some people who don't know what the project needs, you know?
Yeah. Right.
I want to play a game with just your janky tweens and transitions in it just to know what that feels like now.
They wouldn't have tweens and transitions. That's what I'm saying. It just things just pop up on the screen. You just change states. It's great. Yeah.
That could be a vibe too, though. That could be a vibe too.
That can be a vibe.
How you present it. I mean, I don't want to come off. I don't want to come off here like some sort of madman who's just like going off on like wild tangents whenever he's just given a design document or something. I mean, I obviously defer to the creatives on the team, and you know, I get people's opinions. I'm not just going dolo, you know, just
I don't think you've come across in that way at all. At least not to me, especially.
there's an element of like saying the unsaid, or like, you know, there's the juice, the sauce. You know, you gotta sprinkle it in. And sometimes I'm always making sure that we're sauced. I guess there you go. We're all sauced. All sauced up.
There have not been many happy hours at work since I've joined, so that is one thing I've noticed. Everyone's remote though, so it's kind of tough.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So the thing that I've always thought about, as someone who came into games from another field, is I feel like I have an empathy for people in other disciplines, even if I don't know all the disciplines, right? Like, sometimes I like to fancy myself as someone who could do any part of it, but I'd like to think that at least I am receptive to the needs of other disciplines. And I think that helps me. But then I sometimes wonder, like, am I just receptive to the disciplines that I am specifically familiar with? That happens to be a number of them. So I fooled myself into thinking I have the capacity for anyone to come to me and I could sort of see, you know, like appreciate their issues. And for both of you, you each came from other fields, but from different ones, and you each have your own little collection of other and past expertises. Do you find yourself able to quickly pick up the needs of totally unrelated fields, or do you find yourself just really good at those other things also?
Oh, I'm not particularly good at some of the things that I work really well with. I would say one of my knacks is being able to like work very well with graphic artists and designers, and like to point out where we could have adjustments to our art to do something that I think usually winds up being better. But I don't have those skills myself. I have enough familiarity with the tools that in a pinch I can like deal with something that isn't perfect. But and I would only really do that if the designer wasn't available. if something where, oh, I'm trying to get something done and I'm working late and they're offline and I need to make an adjustment to this particular like Photoshop file in order to get these things to line up properly so that we no longer have this collision that's occurring. It's like, yeah, I can do that kind of stuff. But it's more about interfacing with them productively and having good conversations with them and figuring out what you can do to help them see the next step, mm-hmm. so that they can get the clearest picture the fastest. Like, I think that is kind of how like my interaction with visual design works. Like, I have a pretty good eye for it. I can't really do it. I can have conversations about it that are productive. So I definitely do rely on having some very talented designers and artists working with me in order to make some of the really good looking games that we've put together. But in terms of the other disciplines that we encounter in a day-to-day basis, I've had enough just interactions with people in those kinds of roles, strangely, like even though it was all public sector everything beforehand, still just like a lot of project management disciplines. I was constantly dealing with those kinds of people. I was constantly making business cases for initiatives. So when I'm dealing with like trying to propose a project or deal with a bid in response to an RFP from some prospective client, then I've had enough similar experience that I can draw upon to do those kinds of things or to interact with the people who are doing it. The one thing where I definitely do wind up doing stuff that might not be in my specific area of responsibility is editing the copy.
Can I tell you a really funny editing copy story? The first project I worked at TGA on, we were getting the copy for the game or the course. I was getting so annoyed because every piece of copy that was coming in, there was only one space after a period. And so I was doing search and replace to add two spaces after the period.
No.
You were vandalizing this document? What?
on all the game copy, right? So then the project manager, Kara, comes up to me and she's like, Jamal, why is there two spaces after every period?
Jamal.
And I'm like, yeah, you're welcome. I fixed it for you. This is like common grammatical rules, right? And then she was like, Jamal, nobody does that. I said, no. I said, this was beaten into me as a child, you know, by every teacher.
It was for me too, but yeah, I had to get it beaten back out of me.
And then I was like, if there's one thing I know on this earth, it is there are two spaces after a period. And she was like, do you want to Google it right now? And I was like, all right, I'm going to Google it. And then I was like, what?
Scales fall from your eyes.
You're kidding me. You are absolutely kidding me.
So my favorite part about that is the favorite part about two spaces after a period is that people on the internet will type it in, but because HTML doesn't allow multiple white spaces in a row, because that's just a convenience feature to get rid of all that white space in a markup document, some people don't. They write it and they don't even realize that it's not showing up.
It's not doing it. Yeah, yeah. I learned a hard lesson that day. But I want to say this in my defense. I went to the gym that night, and there was two people at the gym. One was like a 40-year-old man. The other one was like a 19-year-old girl. And I said, watch this, you guys. How many spaces do you put at the end of a period? And the 40-year-old dude said two. She said one. They both looked at each other. I said, oh, thank you. Good night. So it wasn't me. It wasn't just me. Okay, it was a generational gap, you know.
You just started a war in the gym.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Oh wow.
Anyway, sorry for that. Sorry for that. You know.
That's great.
I'm only sorry about that because I don't have to be the one to strut you trade, because I think that would have been fun.
It was so bad. Anyway. It was so bad.
Oh man.
I changed it all back though. I paid the price.
You can easily change it back. That's a good point.
That's true. You can
very easily.
I changed it all back. Yeah. I changed all the JSON files. It took forever. I was like, this is my punishment. This is my punishment.
That's the lesson. When you get ambition, you have initiative to step outside your area, just know that there may be consequences as a result, and you have to be comfortable with that.
Yeah. I think it's pride comes before the fall. That's what it is.
Yep.
So we talked about wandering into game development. Mm-hmm. We talked about it in a wandering way. Mm-hmm. So I want to bring it back.
Okay.
And I want to ask you guys, having gotten to where you are by wandering, do you wish you would have been able to get into game development earlier? Or do you prefer having had the experiences that you've had?
Oh, I wouldn't have traded being a musician for however long I was a musician professionally. You know, that was a great experience. I think that there is an interesting thing for me, because the joke ended up being on me, but the reason I chose a sort of cybersecurity digital forensics master's program rather than just going straight computer science was that I was very intimidated by the idea of straight up programming, and I conceived of like forensics degree as being something that would be on the periphery of programming and still on the, or you know, be on the edges, but like I didn't perceive it as being like as scary, and that's why I chose that rather than just going straight from the get towards programming. I'm not sure if I would have traded that experience. I mean, the joke was on me anyways, because it was really hard, and there was a lot of programming that was much more difficult than I think. Well, much more difficult in certain ways than just, you know, just game programming or just making an application, right? If you're trying to hack Windows or something, you know, you might be programming less, but like the level of knowledge that you have to do the programming work is like so insane. There's a lot, you have to know a lot to write the little bit that is the exploit, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't think I would have traded that experience either. I mean, even the forensics lab, I mean, I loved the master's program, and I think that I had so much fun there. And I think that even the forensics lab experience itself, while I ultimately wasn't a fan, there were still some some great moments there as well. So I'd still have done it the same way, I think.
Cool. Greg, how about you?
I'd say I'm pretty happy with how things have gone so far. And that, like, all the way through my career, there was just a bit of, like, following what seemed opportune and what seemed important at the time. Everything that I did, as like all of my various steps along the way, I actually found that each one of them was pretty satisfying, and that I learned a lot from everything. And that generally, I would say that my jobs have, like, been well in tune with my values, and that I've worked with a bunch of great people along the way, and I'm glad to have known those people. And that you know, my particular advancement path has had a lot to do with just who I've met, and who was then willing to, you know, vouch for me at certain points that, yeah, this is someone who can do this. When, you know, my credentials don't necessarily say anything along those lines, but having enough of those, like, positive interactions all the way along, I think if I'd gone straight into it, I probably would have gone down some different paths, and they might not have been as satisfying. I'm just thinking from the standpoint of I grew up in the Edmonton area, and it doesn't really have a whole lot of games industry. There's, like, BioWare is the one big company there, and then there's some indie developers that have been showing up lately. And if I had been trying to get into that seriously in Edmonton when I was young, that I probably would have shot for that, or you know, much worse, like before BioWare was acquired by EA, I might have done what some of my other friends did and gone and worked for EA. Mm-hmm. That worked out disastrously for them, and they burnt out and left the career. So I think that I found kind of an interesting niche inside of game development, where, like, I'm able to leverage a lot of parts of my background, where I find the work satisfying on a number of fronts, where we aren't doing anything evil. That's a kind of a big factor. I love the idea that that some of our projects get used to like teach kids to read, and like that just makes me feel good about what I'm doing. I'd say I've been pretty lucky, and I've definitely you know, put in the work along the way, but I'd have a hard time imagining things going better to get here faster. And that those previous parts of the journey are all valuable. So
yeah
who knows what kind of people we would have turned out, you know? I mean, it's hard to replay the past, right? Like,
I don't know
if, like, I would have had the willpower to, like, for instance, slam an entire JavaScript HTML game book in a week if I hadn't learned the discipline to be able to sit in a soundproof room and practice saxophone for 5 hours, you know, a day. You know what I mean? Like, you never know, like, what's informing, you know, what.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a really good, and like the systems thinking that comes from doing DevOps directly. Yeah. Directly translates into what you're working on, like, day to day, with all the different things that go into making some of the games that we have.
It was kind of like cobbling together a whole bunch of little fragments of useful experience into approximately one game programmer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that tracks.
Okay, so we've asked you everything we need to know about the topic, but one last question: what's it like to work with Ellen?
Yes.
No.
It's great.
That's a great answer.
We feel the same, right, Steven?
Yeah.
You know. What more could be said? Okay. Well, on on my side, working with Ellen is basically I set a meeting, and then 5 minutes before the meeting, she slacks. I can't make the meeting, but here's my update.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really don't have been... I don't really have a sense for what it's like to work with Ellen, the person. Yeah. I just kind of like know this avatar that slacks me to tell me that they can't talk to me.
That's actually not even me. That's Alice, my Slack bot, who tells people they can't make a meeting.
Oh, that's funny. That's great.
Well, I'm so glad that you guys were both able and willing to join today. Mm. And I love working with you both, and I do wish that I could work with you more. It's just project work right now is – we're talking about doing multiple roles on a project. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my life right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But eventually I'll come back to those meetings and – you know, you say that, Jamal, but you weren't at that meeting. And someone else had to press the dolphin emoji.
Well, wow. Hey, yeah. You know? So you were at that meeting. You were at the one meeting I wasn't at, is what you're telling
yeah.
me.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's a power move, Ellen.
Yeah.
That's a power move.
I wish I would have remembered that 2 seconds ago.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics and things, it was meandering. It was wandering. It was good. Go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter and Mastodon at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets and toots about game dev resources and the golden rule of video game promotion. Interesting. We like hearing from you, so tweet and toot back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club, that's us, Nice Games Club, is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at licensing and emotional motivation as two separate topics. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to...
play nice.
And make nice.
She actually mentioned you in a meeting, Mark, few days ago, and it was in a response.
What I do?
No, it was in response to me drinking from a particular carbonated beverage brand that shares your last name, and we wound up having a discussion about the correct pronunciation of it, which I, of course, insisted was La Croix.
Right, because you're Canadian, yeah.
Yeah, and
right.
And then found out it was very disappointed that it's La Croix for the beverage.
Yeah, same.
Disappointing.
But no, Ellen's a delight to work with. She's really funny and smart, and she has a great head for how game systems go together, and she's good at critically analyzing things to the right level. She's a downright professional and a lot of fun to work with.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.